You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
I am not at all with anyone. I am not at all with anyone. Go away, war plays. You bring fear and shame. I am not at all with anyone. Give my love to Iraq and to America. Give my love to Israel and to Palestine. We could live as one between the sea and sun. I am not at war with anyone. I don't need to be friends.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. That was Irish musician Luca Bloom and the Gardiner Street Gospel Choir with I'm Not at War with Anyone. Best wishes for the new year, and before we turn to our main story this week, the ongoing bombardment of Gaza, here are two events you can get involved in to start off the year. Tim DeChristopher is the University of Utah student who foiled a federal oil and gas lease auction the Friday before Christmas. The 13 bids he won by raising his auction paddle were on 22,000 acres of land near Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. DeChristopher admitted he'd run up the other bids by about $500,000 and said he would be willing to go to jail to defend his generation's prospects in light of global climate disruption and other environmental threats. He's looking to raise $45,000 to pay the U.S. Bureau of Land Management to hold the 13 lease parcels he won. His aim is to fend off drilling at least until President-elect Barack Obama takes office and new officials are in charge of the Federal Interior Department and the Bureau of Land Management. Three websites have been set up to take pledges: www.wateradvocacy.org, oneutah.org, that's oneutah.org, and www.bidder70.org, bidder70.org. So wateradvocacy.org, oneutah.org, and bidder70.org to learn more about this. And in Chicago, sub-freezing temperatures and a brisk wind did not darken the day in Drexel Park for the kickoff of an 18-day vigil just down the street from Barack Obama's home on the Chicago South Side. It's called Camp Hope, and it's organized by a coalition of social justice, religious, and peace organizations from the Chicago area. Camp Hope's goal is to remind President-elect Obama of the progressive themes he sounded in his campaign and urge him to follow through with policy changes when he takes office later this month. Camp Hope continues in Drexel Park from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day until January 18th, including evening programs of speakers and films. Next week's show will feature Kathy Kelly, an organizer of Camp Hope in Chicago and founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Her former campaign, Voices in the Wilderness, was aimed at ending the UN-US sanctions against Iraq. For bringing toys and medicines to Iraq in open violation of the UN-US sanctions, Kathy Kelly and other campaign members were notified of a proposed $163,000 penalty for the organization, threatened with 12 years in jail and eventually fined $20,000, a sum they've refused to pay. The following interview with Phyllis Bennis was recorded last Friday before Israeli ground troops advanced into Gaza on Sunday under cover of heavy air, tank, and artillery fire. Witnesses said the Israeli forces had punched across Gaza, bisecting its northern and southern parts, and had taken over certain strategic areas, including what the military has described as rocket launching sites. As far as I understand it, however, there are no specific rocket launching sites. Instead, mobile launchers are used. We can expect this escalation of war to significantly increase the numbers of dead and wounded civilians. Following Phyllis Bennis, I'll share thoughts from Israeli Uri Avneri. Let's turn to Phyllis Bennis.
Today it's my great pleasure to welcome Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is a longtime analyst of the U.S. policy in the Middle East, particularly regarding the Iraq War and the Israel-Palestine conflict. She's the author of Ending the Iraq War, A Primer, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, and Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Welcome, Phyllis Bennis.
Thanks. Very good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you with us today, Phyllis, because you have spent so much time researching the issues in this region. And what you're going to do today is help our listeners understand what's going on, put it all in context as much as we can in this short amount of time, what is going on in Gaza, in Israel. And I'm going to ask you, after a full week of unrelenting air attacks in Gaza, we're hearing reports of more than 414 killed and more than 2,000 Palestinians injured in Gaza, about 4 Israelis injured and about 40 wounded. Universities, mosques, homes, police stations, government offices, buildings are bombed, and people are now being evacuated. Dual citizenship holders are being evacuated. And yet, Ehud Barak has said that there's no longer an interest in a ceasefire. What can we make of this?
Well, I think that we have to start by recognizing that these airstrikes are serious violations of international law. Israel is the occupying power in Gaza, despite having pulled out soldiers and settlers back in 2005. They have remained the occupying power by maintaining control of all of the borders, all entry and exit into and out of Gaza for people and for goods, including medical supplies and food. And the obligations of an occupying power are very clear in terms of the need to protect the occupied population. The claim that the attacks are against Hamas flies in the face of the reality that a huge proportion of those wounded and many of those killed have been children. There's also a problem in terms of even those, the numbers vary. The United Nations says something like 80 civilians have been killed out of the 400 plus that are known to be dead so far. There are probably more bodies buried under the rubble. But even that is a questionable figure because it implies that anyone working for the government agencies, the agencies of the Palestinian Authority, which in Gaza is led by Hamas, is somehow a Hamas bomber and therefore deserves to be killed. The reality is, for example, one of the first targets was a police station where a group of about 20 young police cadets were celebrating their graduation from police training. These are not Hamas militants of any sort. These are police officers in Gaza who are the only ones maintaining any kind of law and order. So the targeting of police, which Israel defined as a military target, simply doesn't, in fact, represent what the Geneva Conventions actually allow and don't. These attacks are all violations of international law. Now, there's a question, of course, is the are the Palestinian rocket attacks legal? In my view, no, they're not. Palestinians are living under a belligerent occupation. That's the technical international law term. And as such, they have the right to resist, including the right to use military force. They do not have the right to use military force against civilian targets, however. So I would say that, yes, there is a violation there. But to equate the two simply boggles the mind. One of the issues that we have to look at is, when do you start the clock? Do you start the clock when the first rocket came from Gaza in the last days of the six-month ceasefire that largely held but expired the day after Christmas and began to erode a few days before that? Is that the day you start the clock? They have the right to protect their civilians. They have the right. But if you wind the clock back further, you find that for 18 months, Israel has imposed an almost absolute closure on the Gaza Strip, restricting to the bare minimum necessary for survival, not for health, but for survival, of the basic food, medical equipment, etc. People were not allowed in and out for 18 months. In the days before the bombing strikes began, Israel had tightened that closure so that nothing was allowed in. And the reports getting to the United Nations were that the bakeries in Gaza, most of which had closed for lack of flour, the few that remained open were baking bread that was made from grinding up animal feed because there was no more wheat in the Gaza Strip. So it all depends on when you start the clock. Ultimately, we have to start the clock at the question of Israeli occupation. That's the bottom line source here of the problems. And if we're serious about ending the current level of violence, and God knows an immediate ceasefire is certainly what we should be demanding, it has to look directly to the question of ending the occupation.
And why have we not been able to pull off a ceasefire? It seems as though the U.S. is kind of standing by, wringing their hands, saying, oh, Israel, you need to stop this.
Or well, no, actually, the U.S. is not wringing their hands and saying, Israel, you need to stop this. They're saying, Israel, we hope that you can be a little more careful in not targeting civilians.
Right.
But
yeah.
The reality is the Gaza Strip is one of the most densely populated places on the face of the earth, with more than 4,200 people per square kilometer. That means there's not a lot of ways that Israel can continue its bombing without targeting civilians. The U.S. is accepting the legitimacy of the Israeli airstrikes. That's the bottom line. It's very similar to the 2006 Israeli war in Lebanon when Condoleezza Rice set out what will now become her legacy, to be joined by her doing it again this time, slightly less explicitly perhaps. But in 2006, she went to the United Nations Security Council and announced to the world, we don't need a ceasefire yet. The rationale being, presumably, there aren't enough dead people yet. We need to kill more people before we call for a ceasefire. Right now, Israel is saying, we don't want a ceasefire. We don't need a ceasefire yet because we want to make sure that we get everybody we're trying to get. Now, what they're trying to do militarily remains a little unclear. If they're trying to prevent any more rocket fire, what they've done with this military assault has been to create a significant escalation. The two Israelis that died and then two more, so four have died in these 7 days, while the 420 or so Palestinians have been killed and 1,200 or more wounded. Those four Israelis were the first Israelis to die because of Palestinian rockets in almost a year. So this was not a retaliation for Israeli deaths.
There's been some discussion that this is about the upcoming election in Israel.
There's no question that, at least on the question of timing, the elections played a major role. The three major candidates are vying with each other to see who can be tougher against the Palestinians. The labor leader, Ehud Barak, who is the defense minister and is ultimately the one actually implementing the current war, has significantly risen in the polls as a result of his playing this very militaristic role. The so-called centrist party, Kadima, which is centrist only in the context of Israeli politics, where things have moved so far to the right that the party of Ariel Sharon, without ever changing its politics, could become a centrist party because political opinion has moved even further to the right. Tzipi Livni is taking a very hawkish position because her primary opponent for prime minister in the elections that are set for early February in Israel is Bibi Netanyahu, the head of the right-wing, officially right-wing, Likud party, who has been calling for essentially an end to any negotiations with the Palestinians and a military solution to the current impasse. So all of the major Israeli candidates are staking out the most militaristic approach that they can, and that's what's gaining them popular support. A new poll indicates that more than 70% of Israelis support the current airstrikes.
We see pictures of Israelis in Ashkelon, for example, or Ashdod, standing around, you know, being horrified by a car bombed in from one of these rockets coming from Gaza. And I feel like if we could have those Israelis see the devastation that's going on in Gaza, perhaps there would be a slightly different take on what's happening, do you think?
Seeing a car destroyed, especially if someone's in it, seeing children killed, whether they're Israelis or Palestinians, is a devastating reality. The question is, what's going to stop it?
Mm-hmm.
There's no dearth of information about what's going on in Gaza. I think that for people living in Sderot on the Gaza border, and now increasingly in other towns that have been hit, Ashkelon or Ashdod, it's very frightening that there's the possibility of Palestinian rockets, which can't really be aimed. They're not aimed at anything, which is why ultimately they're aimed at civilians, because mm-hmm. all you can sort of do is point them, you know, more or less east
mm-hmm.
Or more or less south or whatever direction, but you can't actually aim them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very dangerous, and I sympathize with those Israelis who face that. That's, as a human being, that's not a way you want to live. It's not a way you want to bring up your kids. The question is, what's going to make that stop? This military attack by Israel has, as we've seen, has made it far worse. It hasn't made it stop. And, you know, that's the problem that you face when you're dealing with a long-term serious crisis born out of occupation, but that's being treated as if it was a completely separate phenomenon responding to a particular rocket attack.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, of course, most of the rocket attacks, particularly throughout the last 6 months when the Israeli-Hamas ceasefire was largely holding, the few violations that did get through were not from Hamas. They were from other organizations, some of which probably had an interest in undermining the ceasefire.
It appears, I know, in just after 2005, when Sharon pulled the settlers out of Gaza, one of the Palestinian Authority leaders said that what we have now is a free fire zone. And it appears as if he was right. You know, there's nothing stopping these Israelis at this point that are certainly amassed on the border of Gaza ready to go in invading on the ground.
It does look like a ground invasion is probably on the much more likely agenda in the next, probably within the next 48 hours. And that will, of course, mean far more deaths, particularly civilians, but also a significant escalation in the number of Israeli soldiers
mm-hmm.
That will be killed. And in the Israeli political context, that's always an important consideration mm-hmm. because the military is probably the single most unifying institution of Israel as a state. And the vast majority of young men and most young women, the exception being, of course, the ultra-Orthodox men who are exempt, but all the rest of Jewish Israeli men serve in the military, so it's a unifying institution for the country as a whole. So when a strategy is planned out that is known to make the likelihood of significant military casualties very strong, the likelihood becomes very strong, that's something that has a very significant impact on public opinion in Israel. The question will be whether people view it as somehow worth the cost in lives to go in and kill that many more Palestinians. Whether it will actually stop the rocket fire remains a very unknown question.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how the sense that this makes to the average Israeli, if you can, that, you know, here we are, we live our lives as a militaristic society at this point. We pulled out eventually from Lebanon because in some cases, the civilians, the Israelis, were just saying, that's enough dead of our people. Doesn't it make sense that there's got to be a different way of handling this?
Yeah, I think that there's openness in Israeli civil society for all kinds of ideas. The irony is that something close to 70%, the same number that are supporting this current attack, also say they're against the settlement project. They would be glad to give back land if they got peace in return. But they're willing, what they seem to want, what those seemingly contradictory polls seem to indicate, is that what Israelis want is to live their lives and not have to worry about the response to what else they might be doing over the border.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if the Palestinians would just stop resisting,
right,
everything would be okay.
Right.
There would be no violence. And the problem is, if you take a snapshot of what would happen if today all violence stopped, in Gaza, in the West Bank, inside Israel, there was suddenly no violence, what would that mean? For Israelis, it would mean a pretty perfect life. It's the 20th wealthiest country in the world, good relations with people all over the world. They have passports and airports. They can get on a plane and go wherever they want. They can buy whatever they want, an advanced industrial society, very high tech. Everybody has access to computers, etc. Everything would be great. If you stop the violence today in the occupied Palestinian territories, what do you have? Well, in Gaza, you have starvation. You have a population that is 80% completely dependent on UN-supplied foodstuffs for basic survival, with over 70% unemployment. In the West Bank, you have an escalation just in the last year since the Annapolis peace talks. You have an escalation of 38% faster settlement expansion, more land being stolen, and a set of the apartheid wall and a set of other walls, enclosures, and checkpoints that keep people in their village, in their town, unable to move, unable to go to work, kids unable to go to school, teachers unable to get to their classrooms, doctors unable to get to their clinics, patients unable to get to their doctors. You have people stuck. So even if there's no violence on any given moment, the reality of living under occupation remains. So the question of we have to stop the violence is a very one-sided approach to what a solution might look like.
And I think this is a really important point. I think that there's not really an awareness in this country of how much oppression is going on in the Palestinian areas. The Ariel, these settlements, I think, are thought of as little outcroppings, but in fact they're huge, real towns, aren't they?
Yeah, and in some cases they're pretty big towns. For example, Ma'ale Adumim, which is a huge settlement in the West Bank, just outside of Jerusalem. Ma'ale Adumim is a town of almost 40,000 people. It has two colleges, several high schools, swimming pools, libraries, and it's a very modern, relatively pretty town. It looks, well, if you like sort of the Los Angeles suburban style. It's on a hillside, and it has plenty of water and lawns, and it's a lovely place. And ironically, most of the people who live there are not ideological settlers. They don't have any claim to greater Israel. They're not either religious or nationalist extremists. They moved there because the government subsidized it. It was cheaper to buy a house there than somewhere else. The houses are bigger, the land is nicer, the air is cleaner, and they don't even view themselves right now as settlers. Some of them are very active in the Israeli peace camp, for instance. But the reality is they are on stolen land, so there's that kind of contradiction where when you make these changes on the ground and continue them and simply build on them, it becomes no longer a violation of international law, but it's just this is where we live. This is our land.
Mm-hmm.
They stop forgetting that they're settlers.
And then the other thing that happens, of course, is the road closures, the roads that are then become specifically for those communities that the Palestinians may not drive on in many cases.
Exactly. I mean, this is something that there was a delegation of South African activists, about half of them Jewish, all long-term anti-apartheid activists, who went to Israel and to the occupied territories about a month ago, and they came back stunned by what they said, by what they saw. One of them said, you know, in all the time that we fought against apartheid, we never had roads that Africans couldn't drive on. Recently, the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation sponsored a 2.5-week, 11-city speaking tour with the Palestinian lawyer Diana Bhutu and the anti-apartheid activist and currently the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, Eddie McHugh. And one of the things that Eddie reminded audiences of, you know, in his tour across this country, was that the PATH system in South Africa played the same role as the closures in the occupied territories of keeping people apart. It's ironic, of course, that the apartheid wall, Israelis often bristle at that name, but it's exactly the name they use. They use they call it the separation
barrier
instead of wall, but they call it separation The word separation in Hebrew, hafrada, is the same word as the word apartheid in Afrikaans.
Mm. Well, I grew up in apartheid South Africa. I lived there in 75, and I actually lived in Israel for a couple of years, and was back there in 2005. And first of all, I was shocked at how the country has grown, and second of all, I was amazed at how similar it is to apartheid. But in many ways, it's actually worse, simply because in South Africa, apartheid was. People were pushed into enclaves in a way, but where they weren't bombed.
Another point that Eddie McHugh and others have made, that in all the years of the apartheid regime and its oppression, they never had tanks in the settlements. They never had planes bombing their cities.
Yeah. It is true that the roads in the South African townships were actually designed to accommodate tanks if they did need them. But and we saw a lot of what we call the buffaloes, the military vans going in on those roads. But so there are similarities, and I know that the Israelis hate to hear that. But
I think that what's more important, actually, than the direct similarities, because certainly there are similarities, but there's also plenty of differences. But what is important, I think, is that the Israeli practices are violations of the International Covenant Against Apartheid, which is a part of international law passed in 1973. To me, that's more significant than whatever we may think is identical or similar or quite different than the South African model, because the covenant against apartheid was designed deliberately for the international community to send a message to the world that it's not only about South Africa, that it's also about making clear that this kind of discriminatory, institutionalized discrimination by a government is not acceptable. And whether it's carried out in South Africa or in the occupied Palestinian territories, it doesn't matter. It's illegal in both situations, and I think that's what we have to keep in mind.
And why are we not keeping that in mind? How is this getting? How is this continuing with those kinds of covenants?
Well, I think that it is increasingly on the agenda. I think that we are hearing more and more about Israeli apartheid. We're hearing, as I said, we had a tour that ended about a month ago of across 11 cities across the United States that was called Separate is Never Equal, Stories of Apartheid from South Africa and Palestine. We never could have done that 2 years ago. The opposition would have been fierce.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say we didn't have any opposition. Of course we did. But the discourse is changing. President Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, was so important because he was brave enough to call it what it is, to use the word in the title. It doesn't mean everybody's reading the book. It doesn't mean the book is the best book around. The book has a lot of problems, in my view, but it doesn't matter because it broke a taboo. The book by Walton Mearsheimer, the notable, very mainstream mm-hmm. historians who challenged for the first time in a mainstream publication mm-hmm. like that the Israeli lobby, was important precisely because it broke a taboo. Again, not because it's the best analysis of the lobby around. It broke a taboo.
Mm-hmm.
The taboos are falling. The rise of Jewish anti-occupation organizations all over the country is a rising phenomenon. The U.S. campaign, we've been doing a whole educational effort on the issue of apartheid with fact sheets. Why do we use the term apartheid? What is the international law on apartheid? Why does it apply to Israel? And we're getting more and more interest in that. So the discourse is absolutely changing.
Phyllis, tell our listeners where they can get hold of these documents.
The U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation, you go to the resources section and you'll find them all. That's endtheoccupation.org. You can find more of my work at the IPS website, which is ips-dc.org. And finally, for a good set of documents on the current crisis in Gaza, including some of the UN documents and others, a new website that is Gaza Siege, one word, GazaSiege.org, has a very good assortment of documents as well.
And I just want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Phyllis, let's talk a little bit about the mindset of occupation. We're seeing it in Israel, but we're also familiar with it in Iraq at this point. And you've done a lot of work on that.
Well, I think that one of the ironies is that the horror of the Iraq war and occupation has made it more possible for people in this country to understand what the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem look like. Because I think it's true that many people have the idea, for example, a checkpoint. We envision somehow like a toll booth on a U.S. highway where you stop for a second, show your ID, or swipe your ID, and you're on your way, as opposed to huge lines of people with endless delays. Often checkpoints are actually closed, with two or three young Israeli soldiers, 17, 18 years old, doing their duty in the West Bank with their large guns, in control of an entire community, of no sense of the rights of people to move around in their own. And we're not talking here about checkpoints between the West Bank and Gaza, between the West Bank and Israel, for instance. We're talking about within the West Bank. These walls, 85% of the apartheid wall is not on the green line, the line that separates Israel from the West Bank. It's inside the West Bank. The city of Qalqilia is completely surrounded by the wall with one gate for a city of almost 40,000 people to get in and out. So this is what, you know, this is what we're talking about. Some of the bigger checkpoints, for example, the checkpoint between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, this is ordinarily a 15-minute drive. Bethlehem might as well be a suburb of Jerusalem. It now has a giant airplane hangar-sized terminal that is far more reminiscent of an airport terminal, or more likely an international border, than anything remotely resembling a, quote, checkpoint. So the situation involving how people are penned in, and this is in the West Bank, which is far better off than people in Gaza, who are essentially in a large open-air prison, crowded, without adequate food, water, electricity, fuel, etc., in the same conditions. So it's, you know, the nature of occupation. I don't think occupations differ all that much. I'm not sure that the German occupation of France in World War II is very different than the earlier U.S. occupations of places like the Philippines. I think military occupation is a bad thing, whoever does it and whenever it happens. And it's hated and it's resisted by the people who are occupied.
Phyllis, in one of your videos, you mentioned that after the attack on Jenin, which was in 2002, an emissary went from the United States to the Israelis and asked if the Israelis could help train American troops on how to deal with Arab culture.
Yeah, this was in preparation for the U.S. Invasion of Iraq. This was, we should note, almost a year before the U.S. invasion. It was at a time when the Bush administration was claiming they had not decided to invade yet, that it was still an open question. But clearly it was not a still open question. They were already planning for it, and the U.S. military engaged the IDF for training. Not that the U.S. needs Israel or anybody else to teach them how to occupy other countries. They're quite good at that. But they realized that the years of Israeli occupation, and particularly the remilitarization of the occupation that took place in Jenin and all the other cities of the West Bank in April of 2002, meant that the Israelis were in a very strong position to train U.S. soldiers on how to take advantage of particular cultural and religious and regional factors. What fear factors could be magnified in dealing with Muslims? What were the cultural things that could be used for interrogation that had particular resonance in Muslim or Arab culture? And indeed, some of the things that we saw at Abu Ghraib, for instance, the interrogation techniques, the forced nudity, the so-called stress positions, are all things that have been used historically by Israelis against Palestinian political prisoners and detainees.
And so by having our troops aware of how to do this, we're actually increasing both our quote-unquote effectiveness, but we're also occupying, I would say, our minds in a sense that our troops now think it's okay for this kind of training to go on.
Exactly. This is one of the the sad realities of how military occupations come back to haunt the countries from which the military occupiers come.
And it's not something that we really like to talk about or even that we really understand in context in the United States.
Indeed.
How can we, you know, as a, I'm actually the mother of a soldier who was in Iraq, he's no longer in the military, but I work very much with the troops and the military families, and I find it a very difficult conversation to have because there's almost a lack of understanding of how these things work. It feels very instrumental to me. Oh, we do this and we do that, and then we come home and everything's fine.
Yeah, and that's why we're seeing the tragic results domestically of the Iraq War, the levels of violence, PTSD patients, with explosive tempers because they're not given treatment. The Army doesn't want to admit that it is such a widespread problem. The problems of family violence carried out by soldiers who have come back from these horrific experiences in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's why organizations like Military Families Speak Out, Iraq Veterans Against the War, are so important in providing support for the service members and families when they come back, when they realize, when they to confront what they have been part of. So these organizations that have played such a crucial role in the anti-war movement are also very important in their own right for those kinds of providing that kind of support for people coming back.
And the thinking certainly has evolved. I mean, I remember when this war first started in Iraq, there was this whole discussion around who was a patriot and who was not a patriot and how we needed to support the president and so on. And that certainly evolved into a more complex way of thinking about war. But we still have a long way to go, don't we?
We do indeed. There's not enough understanding. There's not enough willingness to challenge mainstream orthodoxy. And I think there's an awful lot of people who were very mobilized around the Obama campaign because he said there would be change and I will end the war. Now, many of us know that he said from the beginning that he defined ending the war very differently than we did. His definition of ending the war did not ever say, I will bring home all the troops, I will bring home all the mercenaries, I will close the bases, and I will stop controlling Iraqi oil. But people heard the first part, I will end the war.
Mm-hmm.
It means that there's a huge mobilized constituency to whom he is accountable for leaping to the front of the line of the candidates that had a chance to win. I'm putting aside those who had a much more principled view, who did share our view on what it means to end the war, people like Denis Kucinich and others. But of those who had a chance to win, what sped Barack Obama to the front of the line was precisely the understanding that that people believed he would end the war and he would bring change. It means we have a huge responsibility now to hold him accountable for those claims. It's very similar to the position of the unions and the progressive organizations in the 30s when FDR was in power, following the devastation of the 1929 crash and all of the economic implications that followed. And organizations were pushing him to create the New Deal. And at the end of the day, in a private meeting with some of his progressive allies, he said, okay, you guys, you've convinced me. Now go out there and make me do it. That's what we have to do with Barack Obama. We have to have an inside strategy to remind him of what his commitments were and how to do it and what it will look like. And then we've got to go outside and mobilize to make him do it.
And at the same time, we have someone like Hillary. I always think of her as we'll obliterate them, Hillary Clinton, speaking about the Iranians a few months back.
This is going to be Barack Obama's foreign policy. I think the reason it took so long to vet Hillary Clinton was not so much because Bill Clinton has whatever ties he has all around the world, but because Obama needed to convince himself that when he sends Hillary Clinton to some hotspot and she goes head-to-head with some foreign leader, that she'll be representing his foreign policy and not her own.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reasons, he convinced himself that that's the case. Again, it's up to us to hold him accountable. Left to their own devices, it won't happen.
What do you personally think of Hillary as Secretary of State, the choice of Hillary as
Secretary? I was very disappointed. I think it sent a message that this is not a commitment to change. This is more of the same. I think it was a very bad choice. But I also think that Obama is a very different kind of president, and I think that that's our obligation, to hold him accountable to the promises he made.
Mm-hmm.
And not to the disappointments that we've seen so far.
Well, it's true. I also think that he's a very different kind of politician. He's a very different kind of person, actually, because he has a language that is kind of ahead of the curve of for politicians, this language of transformation. And one of the things that he has to do, actually, is teach us what transformation actually is, doesn't he?
That's right, and having an intellectual in the White House is going to be a very refreshing reality.
Again, give us a place that people can get in touch with you.
The U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation at endtheoccupation.org, and my website at IPS is ips-dc.org.
Thanks, Phyllis Bennis.
Thank you.
That was Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Now I'm going to switch over to a well-known Israeli, Uri Avneri, who was born in Germany in 1923 and immigrated to Palestine in 1933. He was a member of the underground Irgun, by today's standards, a terrorist organization. He served in the 1948 war and was wounded in action twice. Since 1948, Uri Avneri has advocated the setting up of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. This is the two-state solution that not all of us agree with, but Uri Avneri's position is that there should be a two-state solution to the situation in Israel and the West Bank. In 1974, Uri Avneri was the first Israeli to establish contact with PLO leadership. In 1982, he was the first Israeli ever to meet Yasser Arafat after crossing the lines and besieged Beirut. He has served three terms as a member of the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, and he's a founding member of the Israeli Council for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, as well as Gush Shalom, which is the peace bloc, the independent peace movement. He's a former publisher and editor-in-chief of Ha'alom Hazeh, the news magazine, Today's World, and is a columnist for Ma'ariv Daily. Avneri regularly sends out missives on his take on what is transpiring in the region, and I receive these. Today I want to read one written on January 2nd, about the situation in Gaza. He calls this piece Molten Lead. Just after midnight, Al Jazeera's Arabic channel was reporting on events in Gaza. Suddenly, the camera was pointing upwards towards the dark sky. The screen was pitch black. Nothing could be seen, but there was a sound to be heard, the noise of airplanes, a frightening, terrifying droning. It was impossible not to think about the tens of thousands of Gazan children who were hearing that sound at that moment, cringing with fright, paralyzed by fear, waiting for the bombs to fall. Israel must defend itself against the rockets that are terrorizing our southern towns, the Israeli spokesman explained. Palestinians must respond to the killing of their fighters inside the Gaza Strip, the Hamas spokesman declared. As a matter of fact, the ceasefire did not collapse because there was no real ceasefire to start with. The main requirement for any ceasefire in the Gaza Strip must be the opening of the border crossings. There can be no life in Gaza without a steady flow of supplies. But the crossings were not opened except for a few hours now and again. The blockade on land, on sea, and in the air against 1.5 million human beings is an act of war, as much as any dropping of bombs or launching of rockets. It paralyzes life in the Gaza Strip, eliminating most sources of employment, pushing hundreds of thousands to the brink of starvation, stopping most hospitals from functioning, disrupting the supply of electricity and water. Those who decided to close the crossings, under whatever pretext, knew there is no real ceasefire under these conditions. That is the main thing. Then there came the small provocations which were designed to get Hamas to react. After several months in which hardly any custom rockets were launched, an army unit was sent into the strip, quote, in order to destroy a tunnel that came close to the border fence, unquote. From a purely military point of view, it would have made more sense to lay an ambush on our side of the fence. But the aim was to find a pretext for the termination of the ceasefire in a way that made it plausible to put the blame on the Palestinians. And indeed, after several such small actions in which Hamas fighters were killed, Hamas retaliated with a massive launch of rockets, and, lo and behold, the ceasefire was at an end. Everybody blamed Hamas. What was the aim? Tzipi Livni announced it openly, to liquidate Hamas rule in Gaza. The custom served only as a pretext. Liquidate Hamas rule? That sounds like a chapter out of the March of Folly. After all, it is no secret that it was the Israeli government which set up Hamas to start with. When I once asked a former Shin Bet chief, Yaakov Peri, about it, he answered enigmatically, "We did not create it, but we did not hinder its creation." For years, the occupation authorities favored the Islamic movement in the occupied territories. All other political activities were rigorously suppressed, but their activities in the mosques were permitted. This calculation was simple and naive. At the time, the PLO was considered the main enemy. Yasser Arafat was the current Satan. The Islamic movement was preaching against the PLO and Arafat and was therefore viewed as an ally. With the outbreak of the First Intifada in 1987, the Islamic movement officially renamed itself Hamas, which is the Arab initials for Islamic Resistance Movement, and joined the fight. Even then, the Shin Bet took no action against them for almost a year, while Fatah members were executed or imprisoned in large numbers. Only after a year were Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and his colleagues also arrested. Since then, the wheel has turned. Hamas has now become the current Satan, and the PLO is considered by many in Israel almost as a branch of the Zionist organization. The logical conclusion for an Israeli government seeking peace would have been to make wide-ranging concessions to the Fatah leadership, ending of the occupation, signing of a peace treaty, foundation of the State of Palestine, withdrawal to the 1967 borders, a reasonable solution of the refugee problem, release of all Palestinian prisoners. That would have arrested the rise of Hamas, for sure. But logic has little influence on politics. Nothing of this sort happened. On the contrary, after the murder of Arafat, Ariel Sharon declared that Mahmoud Abbas, who took his place, was, quote, a plucked chicken. Abbas was not allowed the slightest political achievement. The negotiations, under American auspices, became a joke. The most authentic Fatah leader, Marwan Barghouti, was sent to prison for life. Instead of a massive prisoner release, there were petty and insulting gestures. Abbas was systematically humiliated. Fatah looked like an empty shell, and Hamas won a resounding victory in the Palestinian election, the most democratic election ever held in the Arab world. Israel boycotted the elected government. In the ensuing internal struggle, Hamas assumed direct control over the Gaza Strip. And now, after all this, the government of Israel has decided to liquidate Hamas rule in Gaza with blood, fire, and columns of smoke. The official name of the war is Cast Lead, two words from a children's song about a Hanukkah toy. It would be more accurate to call it the election war. In the past, too, military action has been taken during election campaigns. Menachem Begin bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor during the 1981 campaign. When Shimon Peres claimed that that was an election gimmick, Begin cried out at his next rally, "Jews, do you believe that I would send our brave boys to their death, or worse, to be taken prisoner by human animals in order to win an election?" Begin won. Peres is no Begin. When during the 1996 election campaign he ordered the invasion of Lebanon, which was named Operation Grapes of Wrath, everybody was convinced that he had done it for the electoral gain. That war was a failure, and Peres lost the election, and Benjamin Netanyahu came into power. Barak and Tzipi Livni are now resorting to the same old trick. According to the polls, Barak's predicted election result rose within 48 hours by 5 Knesset seats. That is about 80 dead Palestinians for each seat. But it is difficult to walk on a pile of dead bodies. The success may evaporate in a minute if the war comes to be considered by the Israeli public as a failure. For example, if the rockets continue to hit Beersheba or if the ground attack leads to heavy Israeli casualties. The timing was chosen meticulously from another angle also. The attack started 2 days after Christmas, when American and European leaders are on holiday until after New Year. The calculation, even if somebody wanted to try and stop the war, no one would give up his holiday. That ensured several days free from outside pressure. Another reason for the timing? These are George Bush's last days in the White House. This blood-soaked moron could be expected to support the war enthusiastically, as indeed he did. Barack Obama has not yet entered office and had already made pretext for keeping silent. Quote, "There is only one president at a time." This silence does not bode well for the term of President Obama. The main line was not to repeat the mistakes of Lebanon War II. This was endlessly repeated on all the news programs and talk shows. This does not change the fact. The Gaza War is an almost exact replica of the Second Lebanon War. The strategic concept is the same, to terrorize a civilian population by unremitting attacks from the air, sowing death and destruction. This poses no danger to the pilots, since the Palestinians have no anti-aircraft weapons at all. The calculation, if the entire life-supporting infrastructure in the Strip is utterly destroyed and total anarchy ensues, the population will rise up and overthrow the Hamas regime. Mahmoud Abbas will then ride back into Gaza on the back of Israeli tanks. In Lebanon, this calculation did not work out. The bombed population, including the Christians, rallied behind Hezbollah, and Hassan Nasrallah became the hero of the Arab world. Something similar will probably happen this time, too. Generals are experts on using weapons and moving troops, not on mass psychology. Some time ago, I wrote that the Gaza blockade was a scientific experiment designed to find out how much one can starve a population and turn its life into hell before they break. This experiment was conducted with the generous help of Europe and the U.S. Up to now, it did not succeed. Hamas became stronger and the range of the Qassams became longer. The present war is a continuation of the experiment by other means. It may be that the army will have no alternative but to reconquer the Gaza Strip because there is no other way to stop the Qassams, except coming to an agreement with Hamas, which is contrary to government policy. When the ground invasion starts, everything will depend on the motivation and capabilities of the Hamas fighters vis-a-vis the Israeli soldiers. Nobody can know what will happen. Day after day, night after night, Al Jazeera's Arabic channel broadcasts the atrocious pictures. Heaps of mutilated bodies, tearful relatives looking for their dear ones among the dozens of corpses spread out on the ground. A woman pulling her young daughter from under the rubble. Doctors without medicines trying to save the lives of the wounded. The English language Al Jazeera, unlike its Arab language sister station, has undergone an amazing about-face, broadcasting only a sanitized picture and freely distributing Israeli government propaganda. It would be interesting to know what happened there. Millions are seeing these terrible images, day after day, picture after picture. These images are imprinted on the minds forever. Horrible Israel, abominable Israel, inhuman Israel, a whole generation of haters. That is a terrible price, which we will be compelled to pay long after the other results of the war itself have been forgotten in Israel. But there is another thing that is being imprinted on the minds of these millions, the picture of the corrupt, miserable, passive Arab regimes. As seen by Arabs, one fact stands out above all others, the wall of shame. For the 1.5 million Arabs in Gaza who are suffering so terribly, the only opening to the world that is not dominated by Israel is the border with Egypt. Only from there can food arrive to sustain life and medication to save the injured. This border remains closed at the height of the horror. The Egyptian army has blocked the only way for food and medicines to enter, while surgeons operate on the wounded without anesthetics. Throughout the Arab world, from end to end, there echoed the words of Hassan Nasrallah. The leaders of Egypt are accomplices to the crime. They are collaborating with the Zionist enemy and trying to break the Palestinian people. It can be assumed that he did not only mean Mubarak, but also all the other leaders, from the King of Saudi Arabia to the Palestinian president. Seeing the demonstrations throughout the Arab world and listening to the slogans, one gets the impression that their leaders seem to many Arabs pathetic at best and miserable collaborators at worst. This will have historic consequences. A whole generation of Arab leaders, a generation imbued with the ideology of secular Arab nationalism, the successors of Gamal Abd al-Nasser, Hafez al-Assad, Yasser Arafat may be swept from the stage. In the Arab space, the only viable alternative is the ideology of Islamic fundamentalism. This war is writing on the wall. Israel is missing the historic chance of making peace with secular Arab nationalism. Tomorrow it may be faced with uniformly fundamentalist Arab world, a mass multiplied by 1,000. My taxi driver in Tel Aviv the other day was thinking aloud, why not call up all the sons of the ministers and members of the Knesset, form them into a combat unit, and send them off to head the upcoming ground attack on Gaza? This is a piece written by Uri Avneri, a well-known Israeli, called Molten Lead. He wrote this on January 2nd, and it's part of the mailings that he sends out. He's also a columnist for an Israeli newspaper called Ma'arev Daily. You can find out more about Uri Avneri, A-V-N-E-R-Y, online. Just do a search on his name, Uri Avneri.
That's our show for today, and thanks for listening. As usual, all views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Join us again next week with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and Camp Hope, the ongoing vigil in Chicago to remind President-elect Obama of the progressive themes he sounded in his campaign and urge him to follow through with policy changes when he takes office. The event at Camp Hope continues for the next 15 days from 8 a.m. in the morning until 6 p.m. Go to the internet to learn more about Camp Hope in Chicago.
I am not at all with anyone. I am not at all with anyone. Go away, war planes. You bring fear and shame. I am not at all. Give my love to Iraq and to America. I give my love to Israel and to Palestine. We could live as one between the sea and sun. I am not at thank you.